Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wealth Tech Show, CityWire's podcast devoted to the technology that is changing the way we invest and manage our finances. This week, I'm joined by two fantastic guests, Anton Padmasiri and Sri Krishnansen from WealthOS. Anton, Sri, firstly, welcome to the Wealth Tech Show. How are you getting on today, guys?
Thank you very much. Getting on really, really well. And I hear it's your birthday, Ian. So
it is.
Happy birthday to you from WealthOS and the entire team. How are you
doing?
Thank
you. I actually kept this one quiet. So, Anton, when I turned 30 at CityWire, my colleagues bought me an inflatable Zimmer frame. And every birthday since, I've gone really quiet. I'm 34 now, so I might be in need of the real one soon. So
it's coming in handy soon, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. But look, great to have you here, and Sri, obviously you politely deferred to Anton for that question, but it's great to have you here too. Look, we're going to go into a range of topics. We've got lots to discuss. But first, I want to talk a little about what you do at WealthOS, because you're a relatively new player to the market. My understanding is that you offer a cloud-native operating system for digital wealth management. And I just want to strip that back a little bit, because that's a bit of a mouthful. And if you're a techie, it makes perfect sense. If you're less tech-savvy, perhaps less so. So what does that mean in practice? And what are you doing to improve life for wealth managers? And Sri, can I start with you?
Sure thing, Ian. So yeah, you're right. Cloud native operating system for digital wealth management is definitely a mouthful, but I'd love to be able to break that down. Really, what we're trying to do is be the infrastructure provider, the backbone for digital wealth products, such as your digital investing application, your digital retirement application, or your digital savings application. And by the backbones and infrastructure, it's looking after all the technology, the processes, and the infrastructure needed to run these types of products. And so the cloud native at the front just implies and explains that we're doing this natively in a cloud environment. So we're fully exploiting all the benefits that you're getting from being in a public cloud. So infinite elasticity, infinite scalability, and also using some of the really cool technology that comes with cloud infrastructure, like, you know, serverless compute, which I'm sure, you know, and Anton will be able to explain better than me. But yeah, we're essentially leveraging all the benefits of the public cloud to bring you the latest technology and infrastructure to run your digital wealth management products.
Brilliant. And that to me always just means that you're utilizing what's out there, the massive technology infrastructure that exists, so that you don't have to build it yourself. You don't have to have all that in-house. Anton, is there anything you would add to what Sri said there?
So Ian, think back to the last 10, 15 years and think about how our lives, the way we kind of go about our lives has changed in terms of booking a hotel to booking a flight to calling a taxi. Think about how kind of the digital transformation in the economy has changed our lives. And think about, whether that has happened sufficiently enough in the investing and the wealth space. Now, I come from having been a product manager in the wealth space for kind of working for companies like Fidelity and Smart Pension. And, you know, one of the, you know, for me, one of the key things is that there is friction in the existing technology stack that prevents financial services in general. This applies to insurance, banking as well, but wealth management as well, that prevents that level of digital transformation from happening at a rapid pace. And I want to emphasize at the rapid pace, the reason why the Ubers and the Airbnbs of this world have been really successful is they've had a chance to get to market fast, experiment and refine and keep acquiring customers. Now, you know, if you look at wealth management in the last 10 years, all startups who've come to the market, now leaving aside the philosophy of whether they can acquire enough assets in the short term, if you think just about their digital experience and their value proposition, has been natively tech-based. And, you know, they've leveraged technologies like cloud and APIs to be able to come to market really fast. So, you know, and for me, the thing is everything should have a problem. It, you know, cloud native is a means to an end. It's not the end itself. Serverless is a means to an end, not the end itself. And where we are coming from at WealthOS is understanding there are inherent frictions that exist in the wealth tech stack at the moment that prevents organizations from experimenting and getting products out to market fast. Therefore, there isn't enough digital transformation happening. So what we want to do is leverage these great advancements in technology and make available to organizations so that they can have the agility, the speed, and the experience and the propositional enhancement that we so much need in the wealth space.
Yeah, Anton, that's a really, really good point. And I like how you've compared it to mass market tech propositions, because there is a difference, isn't there, between getting something out to the general public and then breaking into the competitive and somewhat exclusive world of wealth. You know, from your experience, because you're coming at this as a new company, how have you tackled that challenge? How are you getting into people's, you know, offices and having those conversations with them to let them know that you're doing something new and a bit different? And are people receptive to that?
Sure. I think Sri will have a lot to add here. But first off, people are receptive. When I set off with my co-founders, Chamath and Chamindra, to, you know, kind of think about Wealth OS and build this platform, one of the first things we did, and as a good product manager will always do, is kind of always validate your thesis. So we built a proof of concept, and inside of COVID, we took it around the kind of the virtual streets of London and New York. We spoke to organizations and said, look, there is this problem that we know of. We've experienced it. We think getting good digital wealth products to market is, you know, kind of, you know, handicapped by slightly older technology, a lot of legacy technology. And we are thinking of building this. And the problem statement has been validated over and over again. And that's why we've come the distance we've come. There is significant validation in the market of the issues with existing tech and legacy technology. Now, there is a difference from people validating that to kind of making it a successful, commercially successful product. And Sri will touch on that. But people have been receptive. People have been, you know, I think it's resonated with people as to the need to move faster, the risk of losing assets to competitors who move faster. And they see the activity that's going on in the market with large banks acquiring kind of, you know, new wealth apps and new robo advisors. And they always see a threat around the corner, that if they don't keep up, if they don't keep enhancing their proposition, enhancing their customer experience, that they might actually lose market share. So absolutely resonating. And I think we are having some incredibly rich conversations with organizations, big, medium, size, and small, in order to help them. And we think that the proposition, our thesis, is one that that will help them, you know, digitally transform fast.
Mm-hmm. And if I can jump in with a fairly tough question at this point, you're having good conversations, but are people ready to take the plunge on something new? Sri, let's have that one from you.
Sure thing. So that's a great difficult question. In terms of the actual traction, it varies with the sales cycle, right? I think what's happening right now is the industry's been in about financial services in general, about the last 10, 15 years, been on a real kick with digital transformation. So depending on who you speak to at which point, it's either we've just caught the end of a digital transformation journey and people have put in technology now that may have just finished a 10-year project of being put in place and already it's out of date. So it's kind of like, how do we go about upgrading this? And then we've just had 10 years of doing it. Do we have the appetite and the resources to go about it as well? So I think it's an interesting time for people to take the plunge. And what we find is those who are kind of like digitally native and kind of embraced this maybe 10, 15 years ago, and we're looking at digital transformation as an ongoing journey, it's not something that's a one and done, they're very much ready to embrace this. And we're having much further conversations with them. Those who kind of thought, oh, I've done digital transformation, so why am I doing it again? It's a little bit more of a educational, bringing them along a journey to understand that, you know, infrastructure evolves. And what you want now is a provider that actually evolves the infrastructure for you and not you having to constantly keep up to date and switch providers over time. So yes, kind of a very mixed answer there. Like, yes, I think there are quite a few really forward-looking organizations ready to take the plunge, but there's also a lot of organizations completing their digital transformation journey or just recently done, really large organizations. And so it's a bit of a bandwidth now for them where, like, you know, do they have the time to consider this? Do they want that to bed in place and then have the conversation? But one thing for sure is people understand what we're doing, and it's never a no. It's just the timing, guys, you know, please come back or please contact us, you know, X number of months time.
Yeah. Sri, if I can jump in there, does that not cause some frustration? Because the idea that digital transformation is a one-off thing or something that you do every 2 or 3 years must be mildly frustrating to hear.
It is in some respects,
because you wouldn't do it with anything else, would you? You wouldn't say, I've fixed my investment proposition, I'm not touching that for 2 years. You know, surely would you not urge people to be ongoing in their approach to tech?
Oh, totally. Like our approach, whether it's the way that we speak to people, but also just the way we've architected our systems is, you know, technology is something that is evolving and you need to have someone look after that and evolve it with the time. So you want to create the infrastructure that makes that possible, not something that, you know, you get a package, you install it on your servers on premise, and then you just wait till the next one comes along. That's hardly a very tactile way of keeping up to date. It is definitely frustrating to see people think it's a one and done, especially when you don't have that approach with lots of other parts of consumer demand in general. Like, consumers are constantly evolving what they want. So how can you expect technology to be the same as what you put in place 10 years ago, even 5 years ago? I know a couple of very large organizations who've actually had to bring back retired employees to service systems because there's no one left who knows the coding language in the labor force to come and like update that. And so their solutions were, okay, we'll just get like some retirees to come in and like maintain that. And what happens when they don't want to come in anymore or they want to retire? Then you go through a digital transformation, but then you hope that the new stack is just going to be fine again, or are you just kicking the can down the road? It's about actually looking at transformation as this is an ongoing journey. And then let's put in place the blueprints and the architecture that actually allows us to continuously adapt and iterate. A lot of people are talking about in the business buzzwords such as, you know, Web3 or cryptocurrency, distributed ledger technology. Those are great buzzwords, but if you don't have a core infrastructure that can handle that, then you're just going to be playing catch up. So right now, most core infrastructure can't even handle that. So you're going to have to upgrade to get to that point, at which point there'll be new technologies to play with that your backend can't cope with either. So it's this constant chase. But if you instead looked at it at, what do I need to have the points, the ports, the infrastructure that can adapt and embrace whatever new technology comes, then you're going to be in a much better position and you will embrace it as an ongoing journey.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at your situation here. Although, Anton, were you going to jump in there?
I was just going to very quickly jump in, Ian, just to add a point there. I think the era of 10 five-year tech programs is over, right? I think we are in an era, as you both have alluded to, continuous improvement, you know, continuous change is the kind of the theme of the game. Because, and actually, whether a single monolithic behemoth of a, you know, technology infrastructure platform is going to power an entire organization is also up for question. Technology has moved on so much with SaaS and the likes of public cloud, composability of modular capabilities, you know, best of class solutions that can be put in, taken away very quickly, cobbled together very quickly, is going to be the way in which experimentation and iteration and enhancements are going to happen. It's actually an oxymoron to think about, you know, transformation, five-year transformation, you know, because things move so fast. You know, look at us just 10 years, 11 years from the iPhone. I mean, the way our lives have changed. So actually, you're talking about 5-10 years as major eras of technology enhancement. And I think the way to think about it is continuous improvement. And the way we think about technology at WealthOS is exactly the same way, is not to be the behemoth of a solution for every problem. It's how do we solve each problem very quickly? And how do we be a part of an ecosystem of solutions?
And take us back to Jargon Corner, because we're never far away from that in this line of work. you were talking about constant upgrades and things changing all the time. And that's very much what we've come to expect from consumer facing technology, isn't it? Now, there's a lovely piece of jargon, which is orchestration. And my understanding is that in wealth tech means, you know, automation of the management, configuration and coordination of computer systems and software. And I assume that means everything just updates as you go along without the person using the software having to actually do anything. Is that broadly right?
It depends on the type of orchestration you're talking about, Ian. There is orchestration in multiple layers of your technology stack. There is kind of infrastructure orchestration. So how do servers spin up and so on and so forth, whether that's automated. But there, when we talk about automation in this context, we are talking about application automation or orchestration. How do different systems come together in a logical sequence to make business flows happen? It's the business logic. So it's the digital way of saying there is an application form where you can give your client data, your payment data, your account opening details, and where you're investing your money. How do you take that application form in a PDF, convert that into a single workflow that has a bunch of sequential activities, logical activities that need to happen? So orchestration, or I mean, if you think about an orchestra, it's the timing, it's dependency management. So that's the exact same thing we're talking about, is orchestration of applications.
Gotcha. And apologies to anyone listening and you can hear the motorbike in the background. I'm not in the studio today, and someone near me is, I think, struggling with their masculinity a little bit around here. So, sorry if you can hear that. Really good point, though, around orchestration and all of that. I want to get out of this kind of slight quagmire of jargon. And again, go back to the idea that, you know, you guys are new players challenging the market with something new. I often talk about the tech ecosystem, and I think it's such an important thing. I think we need to support innovation. That's one of the things I like to do on this podcast. I think anyone listening in will realize that I've given you a long time to talk about your product today, which I don't usually allow so much. But I think it's different when you've got people who are coming in doing something different and something new. I think it's really important to give you a chance to talk about that. What I'd like to know is, from your perspective, what can be done to make the environment and the marketplace more encouraging and welcoming for innovators such as yourselves?
That's a great question. So I guess we are not Silicon Valley yet, but London and the UK is actually punching above its weight when it comes to fintech. I think we've done a lot of great stuff. A lot of great companies have been born out of the UK in the fintech space. And there's because of the presence of financial services, the huge presence of financial services in London and in the UK broadly, there's a number of people who have a front row view to what problems exist in financial services today. And all of these people are potential entrepreneurs. They could think about, okay, listen, I work in asset management, I work in this team, and I know this doesn't work. And, you know, if only we could do it this way. Now, that's a potential idea with a potential commercial legs to it. So I think it's a matter of, does the environment encourage folks who think like that to get out and take the plunge, take a risk and say, actually, I want to try and solve this problem in this particular vertical in financial services. And now I did that. I definitely saw a gap in the market in the wealth management infrastructure space. It is risky. It is extremely scary, especially if you're trying to start up at the life stage the way I'm doing, with kind of mortgages to pay, children to send to school, so on and so forth. But also it's quite exhilarating, and actually making the investment environment more palatable and making capital available, including from kind of state, you know, from state funding. Now, we see in the European Union, the programs like the Horizon program, which has almost committed €98 billion to encouraging startups. Now, we do have the Innovate UK funding, but these can be a little bit bureaucratic to get funding. So if the capital, the investment environment can be a little bit easier to get access from, I think there will be a lot more folks taking risks to kind of make a go at kind of solving some of these problems, and actually eventually making UK a great great destination for fintech for sure, and which it already is. And I think we have to also kind of pay tribute to a lot of good things that's happening. We have organizations like the Tech Nation. We have things like Barclays Rise Program. There's a lot of accelerator, the NatWest Accelerator. We have a growing ecosystem. And I think I heard somebody say yesterday, actually, that UK has attracted more capital, if I'm not mistaken, has attracted more capital in fintech or in tech than actually potentially, or fintech maybe, France, Germany, and Israel combined. So there are really good things happening. But what you see in the US, why there are so many startups, is the availability of capital and availability of opportunity to try things is a lot more. To the environment is a lot more conducive to taking risks. So I think UK needs to just keep doing what it's doing and accelerating. And I think we will see across all financial services verticals, and hopefully in wealth management, pensions, and investments, the same level of kind of innovation and experimentation going on.
Thanks, Anton. I want to go back into your personal story, but first, obviously, we're enjoying a week where the UK's got a new prime minister. So what do you think, you know, a Liz Truss administration needs to do to support the fintech ecosystem that we have here, which, as you point out, is actually doing very well?
Yeah, and I think we have seen the Khalifa review come out. The Khalifa review was commissioned by Rishi Sunak when he was chancellor, and the Treasury has the full backing. And in fact, actually, I got an opportunity to go to one of the inaugural workshopping events where they're setting up the Center for Finance, Innovation, and Technology. Obviously, kind of Liz Truss and her incoming chancellor should give the full backing to that program and ensure that that is seen through. Big bets. So back some big bets. Ensure that there is support given, because that's a huge export market. At the end of the day, UK has an opportunity to export to the world the next generation of financial technology. And at the end of the day, exports from the UK is what's going to grow us as a country, and being an export market is hugely important. So I think, you know, Liz Truss and her incoming chancellor and the team and the opposition, all of them need to back these initiatives where innovation, entrepreneurship is encouraged. And obviously there is, without giving straight out money, but there is state backing and almost state underwriting for big organizations to trust incoming entrepreneurs, you know, the new ideas. If you think about a traditional model, trusting a company like WealthOS for a big bank is risky. Yes, understand, you're new, your balance sheet could be, very thin compared to big players. But how do you let organizations like WealthOS get into the, how do you underwrite it for large organizations? How do you encourage, whether it is through the tax code or any other lever, how do you encourage large organizations to give upcoming organizations a chance? I think there's a huge amount of potential, and as I said, it's not just the government, it's across the political divide. People need to kind of back that, because at the end of the day, we have to become that export economy, and fintech is a great segment to do that.
Yeah. And I really appreciate you sharing your own story about, leaving your job to create something new that you believed in. I think that requires, it's a gutsy move, isn't it? It takes a lot of conviction in what you're doing. So you hit WealthOS since the start, and Sri, you've joined, am I right in saying, a year or 2 years after the founding of the company?
I joined this May. So yeah, right. I guess 2 years after the legal incorporation. Yeah.
Gotcha. And I think the question again, Sri, I will bring you in properly soon, but Anton, I just want to dwell on your story. I kind of want to know what gave you that belief that this is something that you had to do. As you say, mortgage, children, I no doubt a well-paid and good job. you know, it's a big move. So what made you believe that this was the thing to do?
So you call it gutsy, the wife calls it crazy. So not sure about who's right, but listen,
I would say your wife.
So I've always been a kind of I've always been an impatient person. I think incremental progress has never been good enough. I've also I love technology. I think although I'm not a technologist, from a very young age, I've kept in touch with all emerging technologies. I remember my father's first Toshiba laptop in 1995. I managed to hack through to a system to play Prince of Persia. I don't know. You might be too young to remember pixelated Prince of Persia. But I've always been fascinated by technology. And actually, you know, when working at Fidelity, although I come from a kind of a pension subject matter expertise background, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed is working with technologists, business people to envisage what great customer experiences, great products might look like, and building them. And I found I had a passion for it, and I think I had a skill to bring people together to really be agile and envision a product and you know build that product. So and my career also is like, you know, every time it starts to feel like that I'm too comfortable, I feel a bit slightly claustrophobic. So I try to move on to do the next challenging thing. So, I mean, obviously the time I spent at Fidelity and working very closely with these kind of some of the tech stacks gave me a lot of insights, and my interest in technology told me that, listen, there is technology is evolving. There is newer ways of doing this so that you can create the end result a lot faster, a lot cheaper. And, you know, that thesis has been borne out elsewhere, because WealthOS is not doing something completely outrageously new. We are basically just catching up with a lot of other industries like e-commerce. Shopify has built a cloud-native e-commerce platform. Mambu and Thought Machine have built cloud-native banking platforms. We are just kind of coming up. And I knew that actually this as a concept has been proven in other verticals, and this could happen. And combining that hypothesis with my kind of, and I have to give a lot of credit to Chamath, my co-founder, and I'm really, really pleased that Chamath is in my team, and Shamindra. So the three of us, our ability to bring a team together, motivate them, let them showcase their talent, and organize this team to kind of bring to life this vision of a new age kind of wealth management technology infrastructure platform. And that drove me, right? Okay, risks, all the risks aside, that just, you know, even right now, it's really kind of, it gives me a buzz that we are doing it right now. Are there risks? Absolutely. But have we done it in a way that we have increased the probability of success? Absolutely. Is success guaranteed? No. But I think in every step of the way, I have no regrets in the first place. And I'm loving the team that we've built, who's making us look really good. But, you know, so many learnings. So pleased that we did that. It's just, you know, this is the kind of experience you couldn't get in 10 years of working for an organization. So it's the drive, but no, thoroughly enjoyed it. Again, wife calls me crazy.
Well, thank you. And on the subject of making you look good, I feel sorry for the listeners that can't see what I'm seeing, but Sri has the most fantastic shirt on today. I've got to say, you brought some real color to this event. I need to bring you in now. Obviously, Anton's passion for the project is, and what you're building is evident. There's no denying that. What is it that made you want to join the WealthOS project? You know, what were you doing before, and what made you think this is something that I need to be part of?
Sure. Yeah. So what drives me personally, and this is how I very much started my career at a very young age, was I really wanted to help people with their everyday financial problems. And at first I thought of going right up the value chain, and I worked in the investing. Is that right up or right at the, it's at one end of the value chain, was helping to invest people's retirement savings, because I thought that's where I can make a real big difference. And then just over the sort of 13 years or so I was in financial services, I've tried being in different areas, wealth management. I've tried being on the consulting side, the investing side. And then more latterly was actually when I moved to the product side. And I was like, actually, the biggest problem here is not who's investing the assets and how they're doing it. Some great people doing some great work there. But actually, the bigger problem was just people don't have access to financial systems. And that's a huge game changer to how a person's life is. And there are some countries where it's just impossible. Like if you have £5, £10, or even if you've saved up thousands, you just have nowhere to invest it. There are certain countries where it's just so difficult to be even able to access something like savings or investments, let alone retirement savings. And so I went to the product side to see, like, you know, what can we build and how can we like broaden access? And a lot of the innovations I kept finding were on the side of engaging consumers and just, you know, trying to improve the customer experience, make it a bit easier to sign up, you know, robo advice, trying to commoditize things and just improve like the ability to engage with the customer, but didn't necessarily broaden out access. And a lot of the reasons I kept finding was infrastructure. So we'd want to build something like, you know, a micro investing solution or something. And then oftentimes like the cost per head doesn't work or the economics doesn't work. The system can't cater such a small account size or can't cater for that market and this, that, and the other. So I was almost resigned to believe that that's just how it is. Like these are the leading players, the leading technologies and it can't go any further. So I kind of met Anton in one of my previous employers where he told me he was leaving to do this. And so I was actually one of the very tiny, small friends and family investors. And so the way Anton described it, as you probably heard, like there's a lot of faith that this man will get this done. And so I had exposure to WealthOS very early on. And then I was like, okay, these guys are actually, you know, doing what they say. And I think I finally found a solution to the problem. It's infrastructure. And the infrastructure is so dilapidated and antiquated at times that it just needs a bit of a kick in modernization. And what I loved is just the way Anton was approaching it was like, how do we make wealth management accessible to everyone? How do we lower the barrier of entry for new players? One of the things that we're really passionate about is trying to get new community-based solutions to market. So, you know, can the communities of the North create an investment app that really meets the needs of different communities there, rather than us trying to come up with one product fits everyone and shove it down like different consumer segments. So the only way in order to invite new innovators and new community-based solutions is to make it easy for everyone to experiment. We launched our sandbox recently, completely free, that allows anyone to come in and create fully functional prototypes of their big wealth idea at no cost. So yeah, seeing all of these ideas that Anton had and seeing them come to fruition, I was like, well, I can't miss the chance. And that's how I got involved.
Brilliant. And that's really good to hear. And I like, again, what you're talking about, making the barriers to entry far lower and bringing, you know, wealth technology to more people. I think there's such an opportunity there. There's one thing I want to tap into, which is what Anton was saying earlier about how you're learning from other industries, learning from other types of technology. It's. I've always got the impression that wealth tech specifically is quite siloed and doesn't necessarily keep pace with everything else. From your experience, Sri, where do you think that we need to be getting inspiration from if we're to bring wealth tech truly into 2022 and beyond?
Sure thing. It's really interesting. My first experience at wealth management was when I dabbled in consulting side almost a decade ago. And digital then meant how do we take the leather-bound portfolios and then make that accessible online in a PDF or on a tablet? that was what digitization meant.
Brilliant.
I know, right? Like, really. Outside this, do you know, like it's the inside looking in. It's just like, so here's what we do right now. Here's the process our clients want. And then how do we put that in a digital interface? But it really requires us to think, okay, that's the current generation of wealth management users. What's the future generation? What's the potential if we even just broke the barrier of your typical wealth management user and then widened it? And then what are those users experiencing right now with the other touch points in their life? So the whole idea of outsiders coming in or outsiders looking in, you know, it goes all the way from, actually, let's just bring people who've architected different systems. So, you know, when you work with someone who's architected, say, stock exchanges, et cetera, they bring in a level of security and rigor to the infrastructure build process that's going to be very different. When you bring in people who've worked on the product side, and so, for example, like my background, trying to launch technology-enabled products and services for the consumer savings investment market, but just kept on having barriers with the back-end technology, when you bring someone like me into the equation, I'm able to kind of say, look, from a practitioner perspective, these are the things that we want to build, but we can't because the tech doesn't work. And so you have a much more well-rounded and robust back-end system to be able to build. But thinking about, yeah, where should we be looking outwards in terms of inspiration? So customers are getting some amazing experiences now in loads of different areas of their life. Like, let's think about food delivery. If I want to get my groceries right now, I don't even have to move 2 inches away other than to take my phone and then click a couple buttons and that's going to arrive. And if I want, I can also have my savings rounded up from that transaction. I can do banking, I can do shopping, all from just my phone, right? So that's pretty disruptive. But if I wanted to take that money and, like, I don't know, put it into a pension, no chance right now, right? Too small an amount, can't do wrappers, whatever, blah, blah, there's all these issues. So you need to be thinking about tomorrow's generation of wealth management users are Gen Zs, millennials, huge wealth transfer happening. I'm not going to go over the kind of demographic trends. We all come familiar with it. And your show has covered it so well in previous episodes too. What are those users experiencing and how easy is it for them to interact and do things? And then how can we meet them where they are and capture the wealth that ensues from that? So, you know, everything from how people can easily buy things in games now, you know, how can we help them interact with finances in a similar way? I always cite my experiences in Asia. I'm from Southeast Asia and I visit quite often to see family. You have entirely new players in the financial market that have come from very left field industries. So food delivery. One of the leading food delivery and rideshare providers in that market has gone into consumer finance. Why? Because they had started with rideshare, then they started with e-wallets to top up your rideshare and then food delivery. And what they realized is there was balances sitting there. Why don't those balances get invested? So they've suddenly gone into consumer finance. And then to retaliate, the local markets online banking, leading online online banking provider has gone into food delivery because they're like, we're losing a share of wallet because people are putting it in their e-wallets. So you have all these like cross-pollinations happening in Asia, which is a fascinating market of these huge super apps building up with lots of non-financial players coming into finance. And now you have a retaliation of financial players going into those other consumer segments. So I'd say look out at what is making a really good impact in consumers' lives and where are they interfacing, how are they interfacing, and how can we bring those learnings into wealth management?
Brilliant. And I want to take one last turn with this podcast, one other conversational topic. And it's quite an important one. We discussed it beforehand in our email exchange. And we were talking about the importance of diversity and inclusion within wealth tech. Now, I realize that WealthOS, you're based across London and Colombo in Sri Lanka. So you benefit to some extent already from different perspectives. Now, you know, why is it that you think that diversity and inclusion and having a different perspective perhaps gives you an advantage when it comes to the wealth market?
So I can jump in on this one. And I look at it from a perspective of everything from age, different backgrounds, different industries, very similar to the outsider looking in perspective, right? When you understand the difficulties and the backgrounds that you're from, like you mentioned, we're spread over London, Sri Lanka. There are, you know, in Sri Lanka, it's difficult to sometimes invest, again, your savings as easily as here. You've got like roundup transactions, et cetera. But in Sri Lanka, you don't. Our engineers are from a background of understanding what limitations there are, and we're here to fix that with our infrastructure, right? So you automatically have a different alignment of interest because you don't take anything for granted. You look at the problem at hand is how can we make investing easier, having understood the market I'm operating in and how difficult that is. So you bring that perspective versus, like, you know, someone who's in an established market completely understands the idea of things like roundups and automatic payments, et cetera. You kind of take for granted how things were done and you might approach it from a perspective of this is how it's done, this is how we code it now. Whereas you're looking from a solution from a completely different perspective, it does make it richer. And you always have accessibility at mind as well, because you're thinking about how can we make the technology as operationally efficient and as scalable and allows new entrants to come in. So I think that's something that a lot of our workforce brings in. We also have an entirely younger cohort of engineers than I say I've encountered in previous companies, and we're capturing a lot of people straight out of university, and it's been great to see just like they're almost taking us on a collective upskilling journey of looking at technology different, from both embracing different ways of how to code to embracing new technologies to wanting to explore different ways of solutionizing. The problems are the same, right? So we're the infrastructure. There's, you know, overarching the functions that our technology needs to do, like help people take payments, customer onboarding, et cetera. Then you put it into the hands of someone who's like wide-eyed, looking at all these different technologies and trying to figure out how to solve the problem in a new way. I mean, like, why wouldn't you want that as a technology house to have the best, brightest minds and also different perspectives to look at it?
Yeah, I think that's really valuable, because whenever you talk about inclusion, diversity, all that kind of stuff, there's always this fear that it's going to be some wishy-washy, just like let's be nice, virtue signaling or whatever. And on the flip side, there's always someone that's going to want to bash that. But I think the real thing is that different perspectives are good, aren't they? And hearing things from people who aren't you is always going to give you a broader Absolutely. Perspective. Yeah. Do you think it's been quite an important thing to get those perspectives for WealthOS? And can you think of a time actually to give it some actual meat and to put you on the spot a little bit? Can you think of a specific moment when those, you know, that diversity of background has actually helped you improve the product?
Well, so let me jump in here. I think it's hugely important. I think the broader point is, you know, inclusion and diversity has many layers to it. It's got some very visible layers, but there are huge amount of cognitive diversity. You don't even talk about that kind of stuff, but huge amount of layers to diversity and inclusion. Why is it important? It's important not because it's a wishy-washy or thing. It's important for growth. It's important for development. It's important for wealth creation, right? I mean, if you think back to a time, and actually think back not too long ago, when women didn't have the same opportunities and women still don't have the same opportunities, you're not using half of brain compute power of the world population. You're not. So what does that do to global growth if you're not using half the resources available in compute in a brain, right? So the first thing is that it's economically imperative. Inclusion and diversity is economically imperative, and forcing that is every organization's every organization's duty, for if not for any reason, that reason alone. But in terms of having outlooks, different outlooks, how it's important. If you take some of our colleagues over in Sri Lanka, they might not speak the most fluent English, but as technologists, what they're great at doing is they can leverage translation capabilities. Now, what does that mean for our technology stack? You know, if they can utilize translation technologies to build our platform where, you know, the operations team looking at a admin UI can actually view it in their own language, that means why can't we introduce that and take that across not just across the world? Let's say that we have a team in the UK who's a SIP administration team, but they want to view it in their own language, the hub, the dashboard that they're working on. They want to just go and say, actually show it to me in Hindi, or show it to me in kind of any other language, Swahili, right? And imagine being able to do that. Would you, if you didn't have diversity, if you had a single point of view, do you think that might even cross your mind? So I think it's not intentional. You can't force diversity, but it really encourages different ways of thinking, and actually that way you include, and by through that inclusion, you're having a bigger kind of a cohort of people kind of putting their kind of mind to doing things that collectively we can grow. And that's why a lot of the divisive talk anywhere is so counterproductive. It's because actually more people you can bring, you know, and Sri talks about taking experiences to people where they are. And this is it. This is how you do it. And that's why diversity and inclusion is so important for us.
Brilliant. And I've got to say, the translation stuff is really interesting to me, because I've not been in a situation recently where I've needed to rely on translation software. That's possibly something to do with the pandemic and lockdown. Does this technology work well now? Because the last time I tried using translation software, it was quite patchy. Do you find it to be quite good for running an international business?
I think we have made, I mean, there people have made huge leaps on translation, because there is no longer direct translation of languages. So much so, we now have translation technology. Actually, even Google's translation link is what you call a neural network, if I'm not mistaken. It can do not, it doesn't do literal translation, it can do contextual translation. So if I had an idiom in English, that could potentially be translated into the relevant, you know, parable in a different language. So I think we've come huge distances, and actually, I mean, we are not breaking any ground. I think a lot of organizations are building in kind of translatability of their platforms. Even Google Chrome has built in capability to translate overseas language websites directly to English. And if you take any of those, so where I come from in Sri Lanka, originally the main languages are Tamil and Sinhalese, and actually the level of translation capability has improved multifold. So I think there's great advancement made thanks to kind of neural networks, artificial intelligence, and machine learning, and so on and so forth.
Brilliant. And look, I think that's pretty much us, but I always allow people a chance to have a parting shot if there's anything they want to say to listeners of the Wealth Tech Show. You're both grinning, so I'm hoping this is good. Not to put you on the spot too much, but Sri, if you can go first, any final thoughts or anything any thoughts you'd like to share with people, you know, relating to what we've just discussed?
I think if you're looking to launch, or you're looking to upgrade, or you're looking to build the best possible digital wealth management product, and one that's future-proof to cater for as much of the market as possible, think about the technology you need to do that. Think about the viability, robustness, and its ongoing suitability and its ability to evolve. And after hearing this podcast, I'm hoping you'd think of us for that purpose. How could I not? You give me the shot, I'm going to take it.
Yeah, true. I open myself up for that.
Exactly. But yeah, so when it comes to launching that new SIP, that new ISA, that new GIA, please do think about us. We have a sandbox that is currently live and completely free for people to experiment. And you know what? We'd love to just have the conversation to kind of walk you through exactly how we can help you bring your digital wealth products to life and to migrate them onto the latest technology.
Great. And Anton?
Yeah, so I guess the innovator's dilemma, I think there's a book that's written that's, you know, basically maps out how organizations feel that they're secure until they get disrupted. It's a quiet disruption, and it happens all at once. But I believe within organizations, there are people who with great ideas who should be given the space to experiment and try out new things. And kind of my parting thoughts are, go ahead, take risks with your organization, whether you're an individual within an organization, take risks, and obviously calculated risks. And because innovation happens from really, places that you might not expect them to happen, especially in wealth management, if you think you can see ways in which customers can be served better, segments of the market can be served better, you know, think about them and take those risks, because now, unlike before, you have the technology that you can get these products out to market. So as Sri said, you just need to spin up a version of our platform, our sandbox, and off you go. You've got the full infrastructure to build an end-to-end wealth management value proposition. And I can't really wait to see what kind of experiences we are going to power for the next generation. And it's going to be an exciting time for our industry. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of the market in the next few years.
Brilliant. Thank you. Look, that was such an interesting conversation. It's always good to hear from people that are doing something new and bringing something to the market that people haven't seen before. I like to think that we did a decent job of talking around the jargon. There are some pretty long words in there, aren't there? And some things that can switch people off. But I think there are also some really useful takeaway points that people can easily digest too. Look, Anton, Sri, thank you. Thanks also to Shah Omar, who's helped arrange this. I did threaten to bring her in on this podcast, but I think I'm going to spur her from the cameo. It's the polite thing to do. Look, thank you, everyone. For everyone listening at home, in the office, wherever you are, thank you for joining us. I'm Ian Horn, and this has been the Wealth Tech Show. Goodbye for now.
Thank you, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.